Well, hey, it's time for Ask the Tech Guys. I'm Leo Laporte. Coming up, I'm going to show you how to put a hat on your Raspberry Pi.
And I'm going to answer the question, why should I actually replace the ISP's cable modem with my own?
Plus, a visit with This Week in Space's Rod Pyle. We'll talk about the Starship launch. Was it a success? It's all coming up next on Ask the Tech Guys.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Ask the Tech Guys with Micah Sargent and Leo Laporte. Episode 1972, recorded Sunday, April 30th, 2023. Truthful hyperbole. This episode of Ask the Tech Guys is brought to you by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. And by CashFly. CashFly is the only CDN built for throughput, delivering rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods and 30% faster than other major CDNs. Learn how you can get your first month free at CashFly.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Time once again for Ask the Tech Guys. I'm Tech Guy number zero, Leo Laporte. You're Tech Guy number one.
Hello, I'm Micah Sargent.
That's what Steve Jobs did, by the way.
He was zero.
At Apple, because Wozniak said, I want to be employee number one. And Steve said, okay, then I'm employee number zero. That's called petty, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, everybody. This is a show where we talk about the week's tech news. We talk about your questions. We give you answers. We bring in exciting guests like Rod Pyle coming up in just a little bit to talk about. I have to come up with a good name for this. The Terror at Boca Chica. How about that?
How about that?
He won't like that. But we'll talk about was the SpaceX launch a success, as Elon said?
This will be great to hear.
Or not, as the neighbors said. And as, or was it a test, as Jammer B
simply a test
keeps saying.
Do not adjust your dials.
Also coming up, I thought it'd be fun. People hear about the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
You saw a couple of weeks ago, I brought in that 7.3 inch, 7-color e-ink display, which is designed to be a hat for a Raspberry Pi. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe a lot of people know already, but maybe it'd be fun to kind of show you the process of
absolutely
using Raspberry Pi, setting it up, what you might do with it. So we're going to do part one of this, which is to get the e-ink display from Pi Moroni working on a Raspberry Pi. So I'll show you the basic setup process, how you set up a Raspberry Pi and all that. And then next week, I'll probably take me a week to get it going, but I'll show you, I'll talk about what I'm going to do next with this. Cause the idea is maybe, although I think this clock is perfect, but maybe replace this clock with an e-ink display.
Cause then you could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah. Right now, all we can do is the time and we can't even do updating seconds. But it would be fun to have, like, for instance, time, and then I guess nobody cares about our weather, but maybe how many members of the club we have.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Something like that, you know, updating. Or maybe I'll leave this clock here and we'll have the little club thing somewhere on the set. We'll, I don't know. We haven't figured it out, but yeah. It's a start.
It'll have its own camera.
Are you on Blue Sky yet?
I am, actually. I got on there in the early days when there were about, I think, 250 other people. And at that time, when you joined Blue Sky, it automatically made you follow everybody else because there were just so few people there.
It was easy.
Yeah. So yeah. I started out following 250 or so other people, but they've been rolling out invite links to people, invite codes to people. So I got a bunch of invite codes, and at the same time, also just trying to make it possible for more people to join. And it's kind of blown up. And it's developing its own personal language as well, which has been very.
They don't call them tweets, as they do on Twitter. They don't call them toots, as we do on Mastodon. They call them.
I don't even know what it is right now. It keeps changing.
Well, it was Skeets.
Yeah, Skeets. Skeets is the sort of put forth by the community option.
And it's, by the way, the Blue Sky people hate it. But that's the beauty of Blue Sky. So let me explain what Blue Sky is. Back when Jack Dorsey was CEO at Twitter, he kind of, I think a couple of years ago, realized, you know, there is a disadvantage to Twitter. It's centralized. One person can own it. It's one company. And probably at that point, he was getting frustrated by the constant battle over moderation. This was back when Trump was president, and there was push and pull to, you know, you're moderating too much, you're moderating too little, you're shadow banning conservatives. And I think it got to the point where you're saying, you know, no one person should be in charge of this. No one company should be in charge of this. So he put up, I think it was $10 million. Let me get my wires straight because it looks like I'm a robot, which I'm not. I don't think yet. Although there is an AI Leo.
There
in our,
is,
in
isn't
our chat,
there?
And he's doing a bang up job. Anyway, oh, that's worse. I've made it worse. Anyway,
plug him in.
Pay no attention to those wires coming out of my brain.
He's dodging.
So I think at that time he said, let's put up $10 million to fund a foundation. It's not going to be owned by Twitter, but a foundation called Blue Sky, because Blue Sky Research, you know, that's the term you give for research where you don't know if you're going to make any money or it's going to be a product, but you do it anyway, to create, and this was the key, a decentralized Twitter, a Twitter no one owns, a Twitter that is spread out. Now, at the time, those of us, I'll include myself, who were running Mastodon instances, said, well, that exists. It's called ActivityPub. And that's what Mastodon is. It's one of the most confusing things about Mastodon. If you join our Mastodon instance, Twit Social, twit.social, you could follow people everywhere else on the Fediverse, which is Mastodon plus many other things. But you're not, it's not centralized like Twitter is, where they're all on the same, they're not all on Twit Social. Some people are on Mastodon.social. Some people are on Mastodon AI. They're all over the place. So that's the idea. Email's federated. Maybe that's the best way to describe this. You know, you don't have to have the same email. It used to be in the early days of email you did, but you don't have to have the same email server that everybody else does. You can be on anyone and email anybody else. That's called federation. The idea that it's a single service, a unified protocol, but others, anybody can use it and anybody can enter it and become part of it. So that's how the ActivityPub, which is the back end for Mastodon and others, work. That's the Fediverse. This Blue Sky thing, they wanted to do the same thing, but they had some concerns, chiefly about portability. Their main concern was, well, what if you're on a server that you don't like? What if Elon buys that server? You can't buy them all. What if he bought that one? And you said, I don't like that one. You could move to another one. Portability means taking your account and all your followers and just easily putting them over on the other place. And so that's what this AT protocol that Blue Sky created is all about. Well, eventually they had to do a thing, and it's very Twitter-like.
Yes, it is.
Which is, for some reason, this week was the week, maybe a combination of Elon's blue check fiasco and kind of Blue Sky becoming more widely available. But this was the week that a lot of big names said, all right, that's it. I'm moving to Blue Sky. So it kind of, it hurt my heart a little bit, I'll be honest, emotionally, because I'm all in on Mastodon. We run our own Mastodon instance. And hey, we were here back in November. You could have come over here. Some of them did. People like Taylor Lawrence, the Washington Post social media columnist, kind of a, she herself is kind of a Twitter magnet for all sorts of outrage and stuff. And she's been attacked, and she's attacked back and so forth. So she tried Mastodon. She said, nah, I don't like it. There's no retweets. And now she's big on Blue Sky, right? She was the one who I think proposed Skeets. Anyway, a lot of big names have moved over to Blue Sky now.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to tell you what's going on so you understand. Now, it's still invite only, right?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. I only have two invites. You said you got a lot of invites?
Yeah, because I think because I was on in such the early days, I had about five that I was able to give out.
Dan.
I'm down to one now, though.
So. Somebody, I think, on in our club gave me an invite, which
thank you.
I've forgotten your name, but thank you. So there are a lot of people on it. It looks just like Twitter.
It really does.
Friday, they finally added blocking, which I think blocking was a big issue because if you can't block a troll, you're kind of stuck watching their stuff.
That was an oversight, in my opinion.
There's a reason for it.
So stakes.
To remind everybody, this is merely a beta version. It's not even public, right?
Right.
And they know there's a lot to do. And they said, what we want to do is we want to get the federation stuff right first. The distributed ID, the AT protocol, distributed ID, and the federated stuff right first. Then once that's solidified, we know what it's going to be, then we can't implement blocking until we know that. Because, okay, so I block you on this site. Does it mean it blocks you on that site?
Right.
What does it mean?
Does it carry over on my new username?
So they've been, I think, quite reasonable, and they've been very communicative.
I was going to say that's one thing. You always see them talking, and every developer that works for the company is always posting updates on what they're currently working on. They regularly communicate with the community. That has been kind of a fun part of being in it and getting to see how it's being shaped and seeing them listen to folks, which I think is super important. And I have to, even in those early days, they already were doing a good job of trying to nail the protocol, where I switched from this random username that I had to my actual username that I use everywhere. And there was no problem with being able to and keep everything helpful.
Yeah. My handle was originally leolaporte.bluesky.com. I can't remember. And now it's leolaporte.me.
Nice.
So you can make it any domain you control, which helps with verification, right? Because in a way, if you see me and you see it's leolaporte.me, well, only Leo Laporte controls that domain, or you could verify that only Leo Laporte controls that domain. So that means it's really him. What did you make your handle?
I actually am still with bluesky.social. I've
you just changed the name.
But yeah, so.
But you could make it, for instance, what was that name, that domain you bought after?
At chihuahua.coffee.
You could make it chihuahua.coffee.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't impede the fact that you have a website called chihuahua.coffee. That would still work. But it would just be the handle people would search for you on Blue Sky.
Yeah.
Or any Blues. And this is going to be key eventually. Right now, there's only one Blue Sky. But eventually, there'll be many different Blue Skies. And so they could search for you and find you wherever you were. I think in the long run, they've solved some of the issues that ActivityPub had. There's still some concern. People don't like it that Jack Dorsey, the former CEO of Twitter, is on the board. So he's not running it. He doesn't own it. No one owns it. It's it's a public service corporation, or public benefit corporation. So it's a nonprofit that is dedicated to public benefit. So that's good. That's what you want. It's going to be something to watch, right? Unfortunately, right now, it's looking a lot like Twitter in terms of the conversations, because that's what they got. They got people leaving Twitter, and immediately Taylor Lawrence got in a fight with somebody. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be. The nice thing about Mastodon, because it's a little hard and a little geeky.
Yeah, that's true.
It's kind of like small town, you know, geek speak.
Yeah.
But eventually, I suspect Blue Sky is going to take off if they continue to do everything right. Brianna Wu has just tweeted, for instance, "Good morning. I'm a guest on Twit later today, as is Alex Stamos. That's going to be a good show." She says, convince him that it is in his massive audience that Blue Sky is worth spending time. Now, here's the thing. I can repost or quote post. So they have quote tweets, which is something that Mastodon has determinedly said.
We're not doing that.
That fosters exactly the kind of inappropriate discourse we're trying to avoid. I don't want to allow that, but they've allowed that right away. I'll just repost it. But so this is, you know, if you're used to Twitter, I'm looking at my notifications here. You're gonna see there's a following page and there's a What's Hot page. Discovery is going to be an issue. I should be careful because there's no moderation yet. Some of this stuff could be a little, I'm going to stick with my following because I know I'm following people who are okay. So I don't know. I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And I just wanted people to understand when they start reading about Blue Sky, because already it's getting coverage in mainstream media.
Why do we think that this Mastodon has so much of what this has? Why do we think this has at least captured so much attention so quickly?
I don't know. As I said, it hurt my heart.
Yeah, it almost doesn't make sense.
I think it's because of Jack Dorsey's association. Mm-hmm. There was also Mike Masnick had a good piece today in Tech Dirt. He talks about the three different distributed alternatives to Twitter. People really are seriously looking for an alternative to Twitter at this point. I think they should. One is, I'm sorry. Let me mute my, you don't want to hear those. Mute my notifications. One is Blue Sky. One is Mastodon. And there's another one called, now I've forgotten the name, Normo or something. Something weird.
Join Norma.
Norma. And anyway, you can find it at Tech Dirt. And he's talks about why each, and his contention is Mastodon early on got a reputation for being complicated. It is a little weird to join, a little complicated. The association with Twitter reassures people. The fact that it looks just like Twitter. Now, there's some disadvantages. There's no web interface.
Yeah.
But this is going to be solved because it's an open source protocol. Anybody could write, just like Mastodon, anybody could write their own version of this.
A special pro tip for all of you who are listening, so you get this little tip. If you go to staging, bsky.app, you do get a web version of Blue Sky.
Oh, I didn't know
so
that.
So they're working on it.
Oh, and so you staging is the place you put stuff before you release it.
Yes, and it looks even more like Twitter than the app does. Early Twitter, before they added all the extra.
But again, the beauty of this is because it's an open source project, it can look like anything.
Yes.
And so you're not going to be, oh yeah, you're right. This is it, huh? See, you're much more up on the Sky than I am here. I'll sign in real quickly, and then I'll be part of this.
Yeah, be part of the club.
So I just thought it'd be good worth mentioning it.
Absolutely, and there are so many other competing services that are trying to make their space too. There were some Twitter developers who started what is called T2, and they very unashamedly call it T2,
like Twitter 2.
Twitter 2, yeah. Yes, a sort of new version of Twitter.
I'm on there too.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's my problem right now, is I don't know what's going to end up sticking. So I'm having trouble investing any of my time in any of the services past making sure my name is there, and then occasionally when I remember them, posting something.
Here's what I would submit. You know, I've only posted once on Blue Sky, which was hello Blue Sky. Probably the same thing on T2. Here's what I would submit. I think we've learned a lesson because Twitter, which was we've been all invested so much into over, you know, 12 years or something, more than that, 15 years. No, more than that, 17 years. It was started in 2006. Isn't ours.
Right.
We put so much into it, and we used it for so much, and we depended on it for so much. Turned out it wasn't ours. That some guy with a lot of money could buy it and do whatever he wanted with it. Should teach us a lesson that centralized stuff that can be owned by one person isn't ultimately where you want to put your heart and soul.
Right.
I mean, I'd say YouTube is the same problem, right? But a lot of people are doing very well on YouTube. It's hard for them to go away from it. But there's still that same risk.
The folks who are doing it on TikTok, that then whenever we heard about a ban from the government, yep, that's the same problem. You put your heart and soul in it.
At least with social, I think it's probably good to look for something decentralized, mm-hmm, that can't be owned by one person. That adds complexity and it makes it a little more complicated to understand what you're doing. But at the same time, I think we should have learned this lesson. I would hope we've learned this lesson. Anyway, that's all I have to say on that subject. But I thought it'd be worth.
Yeah, definitely worth talking about, especially as folks are probably at the very least seeing the name and wondering, what is Blue Sky? What do I need to know about that?
Yeah, yeah. There we go. There we go. See Alexandria or Casio Cortez on. But AOC says, this is my personal account. I can't post my government account there yet.
Oh, because it's not.
It's not kind of approved yet. So that's an issue, right? And what is her personal account? And the courts might say, well, just because you say it's your personal account, you're still a representative. By the way, that's in front of the Supreme Court right now. Can somebody, a holder of political office, block people on social media? Is that their free speech? Or do they have a right to speak back to the politician? I think they do. And does it have to be an official account? Can an unofficial account, same problem? As you remember, Donald Trump's unofficial account, real Donald Trump, what the Supreme Court or courts did rule, mm-hmm, that he couldn't block people on that was in effect an official account. So it's very complicated out there. Speaking of complicated, Wikimedia has announced that they are not going to perform age checks in the UK. The UK's online safety bill requires age checks on sites. Wikipedia says we're not going to do that in England because it would violate our commitment. Whoops. I'm not going to create a free BBC account. Would violate our commitment to collect minimal data about readers and contributors. We don't want to have to collect your age. This could mean that Wikipedia is blocked in the UK.
So
we shall wait and see.
Okay. I didn't realize it was kind of a sort of ultimatum situation there.
Well,
potentially.
The government also says only services posing the highest risk to children will need age verification. But that's kind of nebulous.
How do you decide? Yeah.
Who knows what that is? It's the eighth most visited site in the UK. The online safety bill currently before Parliament hasn't been approved yet. Places duties on tech firms to protect users from harmful or illegal content. That's not the only way the UK is waving its big baton, because they've also blocked Microsoft's acquisition of Activision. It looks like they're the only country. The EU was set to approve it next month. Many other countries have approved it. The FTC has tried to block it, but the administrative court judge in August will probably overturn that. It could be that the UK gets to block the Microsoft Activision acquisition.
What does that do? Does that just stop Microsoft sales?
Or, well, that's up to Microsoft. Uh-huh. They could go ahead and not be able to do business in the UK. The UK is walking a fine line at this point.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if you've got all these countries kind of sitting there and they've got their hand near their belt. And unfortunately, the UK just drew too fast.
Yikes.
And everybody else is like, whoa.
Oh, it is like gunslingers, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's some thinking that the EU is going to maybe change their opinion.
Oh, now that would be interesting.
I think that's what the UK hopes. All right. Now, we have a show to do. We have many calls.
And we have someone waiting on the line.
Should we do, let's play his theme first to bring him on, because I know that he believes in the power of Space Force. And so without further ado, I am going to play the Space Force theme to welcome our own space guy onto the show, Mr. Rod Pyle. Hello, Rod.
Hello.
Space Force. Space Force. Space Force.
This is not the official Space Force theme.
This is the skating rink Space Force theme.
But I think it's catchy.
This is the Village People version, right?
Yeah. Yeah. S-P-A-C.
Space is a war-fighting domain, just like the land, the air, and sea.
Welcome to Rod Pyle, host of This Week in Space, along with Derek Malik. And you are in Long Beach, because I see the Queen Mary in behind.
There it is, huh?
Yes.
How about that?
Is this your boat?
Foggy, but
you got a great view off your boat. That's nice.
Yeah.
Almost as big as the Queen Mary, too, but in better shape.
They're warning. They had a surveyor come out a couple of years ago and look at the Queen carefully. And he said, you know, if you guys don't put about $250 million into this, it's going to capsize in about 5 years.
Please,
we need to get Elon to buy the Queen Mary.
So I sailed on that when I was 11 years old in 1967. It was his second to last sailing of the Queen Mary. And when Lisa and I went down to Long Beach a couple of years ago and visited, I wanted to go to cabin C-135, which was our cabin when I was a kid, because my dad, knowing he's not a vandal, but knowing it was the second to last voyage, carved his initials and date into the bunk.
Oh, wow.
And they said, no, sorry, that deck has been removed.
Oh.
Wow.
That might be where the hole is that's going to sink it. Anyway, it's a beautiful old ship. And those were that's the days of the sailing ships, the sea, the ocean liners. And it was really, for me, it was a turning point in my life. It made me love the sea, as I see you do. Rod, I got a big question for you, because, of course,
yes, sir.
You guys, immediately after the launch last week, the SpaceX launch, proclaimed it, as did Elon Musk, a success. It's a test. They learned a lot from it. But Elon did something that is turning out to have been a bit of a mistake. Mm-hmm. He left out the flame barrier. What is that?
The flame trench.
That would, in theory, channel the explosion from the launch into safe areas. And we're seeing now the residents of Boca Chica, the nearby town, being very upset. There's a lot of debris on the beach. There's been a lot of damage from this. Elon said, maybe we don't need a flame trench.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Well, so that was a boo-boo, and there's no denying that.
That's
so
not normally a success. You're not going to claim a success for this one.
So normally you have this diverter trench, so it's literally a big hole dug under the launch pad, and often they will have water, like in the shuttle days, they had water deluge system that would come down and also damp out the acoustic vibrations. So the thought is, if you saw the video of the rocket close up, the Falcon – the heavy booster as it was ascending, a number of engines were out, and as near as anybody could tell, and of course, you know, we're still waiting for SpaceX to say something, but as far as the observers can tell, one of the very brilliant ones, by the way, is your very own John Slanina, who came on to one of our two episodes we were doing about...
John's been very defensive of this. He says, this was a test. It's supposed to happen. Bad thing.
Yes.
Supposed to happen.
And he knows a lot, but...
He's a space fan, yeah.
One of the things people are thinking is that part of the reason some of those engines might have been out was debris flying up from the launch pad. and knocking either the nozzles off or destroying the fuel systems or something that caused the engines to fail.
So as people know,
maybe one reason
the launch was successful, got a few minutes into it, but then started to lose course. And of course, you know, all NASA launches have had this, you know, have done this too. They can destroy it if it's going to be a threat. Right. And so they just elected to destroy it in the air. But they did it over the ocean, right? So there was no consequence to that. Is that right?
There was not. However, when you see the damage to the launch pad, you can divine looking at that. If it had stayed on the pad too much longer, had that one of those legs, it looks like a milk stool, had one of those legs failed and the rocket started going sideways, you could have had a very bad result. So that was not a good decision. The reason we're all declaring the test a success, it was a test launch. It was the first stage that they were really testing. They had tested the top stage, the Starship itself, a number of times and finally gotten success with that. But this was the orbital test. It didn't make orbit, obviously. But they really want to know if that first stage could fire up 33 engines and get clear the pad and start ascending. So that part was successful. And, you know, NASA, when they fly rockets now, the SLS being a prime example, you really can't have launch failures because Congress is watching, taxpayers are watching, and people get very bent if NASA makes a big mistake like that and it threatens your program. Musk doesn't do business that way. He's more like the early days of the space race where you build it, you push the button, and if it blows up, you pick up the pieces and try and figure out what went wrong.
Yeah,
so that's what he's doing.
As Jammer B has said, NASA blew up quite a few rockets in the early days, too. It's not unusual, right?
Yeah, and testing the engines for the Saturn V, when they were developing those big F1 engines, they blew up at least a dozen of them during test, and that's just how they learned how to do it better. And it's also worth mentioning, you know, had Musk not come along when he did, you know, leaving Twitter out of the equation, please, had Musk not come along when he did and built the Falcon 9 and had the successes he had, we would be way second place in launch right now because China about matches what SpaceX does. And SpaceX has dominated the launch industry. They had incredible success with the Falcon 9. So I would never bet against the guy overall. I would just bet against some of his decision making. And the Flame Trench omission was a big one.
Yeah.
Was it his decision specifically? Because the guy's doing 50,000 things at once.
Maybe it was Gwen's decision.
How much was he involved in saying, the Flame Trench, we're not doing it?
He tweeted, he did tweet like a year ago, right? We don't need it.
Maybe
we shouldn't do this. So maybe it wasn't Elon. Yeah.
I think, you know, he's the ultimate arbiter of what happens there. Gwynne's incredibly smart. Gwynne Shotwell, his immediate lieutenant, the president of SpaceX. And, you know, she really runs the company day to day and operationally, and they're doing quite well. But the big decisions are made by Musk, as far as we can tell. And I think that was both a cost-saving measure and something to speed up the cadence. And they've got a lot of work to do now to repair that thing. But it's worth mentioning that they've got three or four more Starships ready to go. Because one thing he's done also that nobody else has done is configure this whole thing. So these are built on an assembly line. They can turn out an engine a day, which is remarkable. It takes the traditional aerospace contractors months to do the same thing. And they can turn out a complete Starship top and bottom stage in a few months. So you really can move quickly once you get your bearings, but he's got a lot more testing to do because people are supposed to fly in that thing within a couple of years. And of course, NASA's plans to land on the moon depend on Starship being successful because that's what they're choosing to use as their first lander. So it's a pacing item for them as well.
Yeah. Okay. So when the headlines came out, you know, launch is a success. I said, that sounds like a little bit of spin. But again, if you're saying all we're doing is testing the first stage, okay, the first stage made it. It was a success. But it's qualified. Let's say qualified success. How about we say that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he set that expectation up front, as he often does. You know, he talks very aspirationally in general terms about, oh, we're going to do this by this year and this by that year. Starship's going to launch by 2019. It didn't and so forth.
But well, then he lies a lot. Let's call a spade a spade. He lies a lot.
I think he truly believes that they can if he pushes hard enough and he forgets the disconnect between him pushing and people's abilities because we're not robots.
I think we've learned now that Elon lies. He intentionally lies.
Maybe.
It gets attention. I don't think there's any question now over time watching him He knows what he's saying, and he says it because he knows, A, it'll get attention, and B, it'll get excitement. And he's trying to, he's a salesman. He's a good salesman. And you know what? I bought a Model X with the bioweapon hazard protection, which turned out merely to be a HEPA filter, but, and it, you know, had the big bioweapon hazard logo on it when you fired it up. I, even at the time, I went, well, I guess I'm just supporting Elon's dream of saving the planet. He's a good salesman, but
you can make your seats fart in your car.
He's a good salesman.
And we'll see if he puts that into Starship.
I don't want to besmirch salespeople because, you know, I know some very nice ones who don't lie are salespeople, but a lot of them do. And that's part of the, and they even expect you to understand that that's part of the game. We're going to misrepresent stuff.
Maybe we should call it creative exaggeration.
Yeah. Well, actually,
we'll put our own spin on it.
There is a term for it, and that a former president used.
Sales.
In his The Art of the Deal. I think Donald Trump gave it a name, and I've forgotten what it is. But it's a lie. A lie by any other name is a lie. It's a misrepresentation of the facts. A knowing misrepresentation of the facts. So I don't want Elon to get off the hook on that.
And I should say, you know, immediately upon the conclusion of that test flight, you know, the internet just lit up with people going back and forth. And he said, she said, and a lot of armchair quarterbacking. And that's what Tariq and I addressed in Friday's episode of Sweet in Space.
Yes, because there's some.
Let's talk about.
Yeah, let's have some knowledge on this.
But, you know, the facts are it worked mostly and they've got a lot of work to do, but the thing does fly. And let's, you know, bear in mind. And I mean, my heart goes out to the residents of Boca Chica because this really is.
It was a 3.5-acre wildfire that was started by it. You know, that's not.
Yeah. And, you know, fuel tanks are too close to the launch pad and the facility isn't big enough. That whole thing was originally planned and sold to them. Speaking of obfuscating. As a place to do research on the Falcon 9. And then the next thing they know, this thing twice the power of the Saturn V shows up. So blowing chunks of concrete all over a couple hundred acres is not the best way to make friends where you're building and launching your rockets. The problem is, you know, there's not that many places in the United States you can do this because you need to be able to go east over the ocean and you need to be far enough away from populated areas that you're not going to cause substantial risk. So NASA does it in Florida. Elon's doing it down in the south of Texas. About the only other place you could do this is either offshore on some kind of floating launch pad or out in one of the Central Pacific Islands, which is where Von Braun originally wanted to launch heavy rockets out in Christmas Island. But the logistics of that are just brutal. So there aren't a lot of other places you can choose. But yeah, if you're at Boca Chica, on the one hand, you're getting dust and crud scattered all over your house, and you're not very happy about that. On the other hand, the money that comes in from the people that descend on this heretofore very quiet little burg from these launches is a godsend. So it's a mixed blessing for sure.
The term, by the way, that former President Trump coined for this is truthful hyperbole. He says the final key to the way I promote, this is from The Art of the Deal, is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. And by the way, put Elon Musk hat on here. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. I call it truthful hyperbole. It's an innocent form of exaggeration. And this is the most important part, a very effective form of promotion.
Yeah, and it gets people to inject bleach so that they don't get sick.
But, you know, and I understand, I think Elon probably thinks in service of this goal of getting us off the planet, a little truthful hyperbole is not unwarranted. And I guess I understand that, so I won't hold it against.
Yeah, and it's worth also remembering, you know, SLS worked. It's great. We need a government moon rocket to be able to complete what we're trying to do. But it's roughly 4.2 to 4.4 billion per flight Starship. But its most expensive will probably come out to about 150 million. Because remember, this is his money. He did get some money from NASA to develop that thing as a lunar lander. But the development of the system itself is his own investment with his fellow investors. And he's not costing us money to do it. So as long as he doesn't hurt anybody, I think that's a net win.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to, honestly, no one lies more than a politician. So if you have a choice between Elon and government, it's the lesser of two evils, maybe, perhaps. Yeah. Certainly the cheaper of two evils. And frankly, the way the government's planned this moon mission is insane because you have two different.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think. That's good. Oh, you're very diplomatic.
There I go. There you Creative go. Hyperbole. Yeah.
This Week in Space is every Friday.
Yes, sir.
Tell
we're
us
having
more.
A blast, thanks to you guys. Well, we're keeping up with the pace. Tarek's turned out to be a wonderful partner.
Space.com editor-in-chief. And Space.com has so much content. In fact, they were there at the launch.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, so there's some really great.
And content. He giggled through the whole thing. If you saw the recording he did.
Oh, yeah.
He said, I couldn't control myself. You know, it was so cool. And, you know, I never saw a Saturn V launch. I saw a number of shuttle launches. I've seen smaller rockets. But to have a chance to go see this thing, he said, was just transferable.
You can feel it. I mean, envious, and he's miles away. He's not even that close to it.
5 miles.
You feel it in your chest. It's incredible. Yeah.
And you want to be 5 miles away because something with that much energy contained inside that tank
is
the equivalent of a small nuclear weapon.
Especially without a diverter chain. You definitely want to be.
Well, yes.
That's far away as possible.
There was some conjecture, by the way. You know, there a car or two that got mangled by chunks of concrete. Tarek actually postulated just from stuff he heard on the ground near Boca Chica, that there might have been some deliberation and let's park this old car there and see what happens. But a couple of cars got
an SUV,
but they were parked too close.
Yeah, don't park close.
They were way too
close. Next time.
You know better.
5 miles.
And that's why NASA keeps everybody at least 3 miles from any launch because, you know, they don't want the liability.
All right, John, go ahead. Wait, John's going crazy here. You don't like it that.
It was a camera. They knew that they were close.
There were cameras put there so they could catch it. Yeah.
And microphones stuff.
And they knew they'd be blown up.
And there were other vehicles there didn't get hit by chunks of concrete. They just got unlucky.
Here's the good news. Many cars did not get crushed by the launch.
This is true.
In fact, let's put it this way. The vast majority
of cars
did not get crushed by the launch.
And most homes did not get their windows shattered. So, you know, let's call that
where do we stand? Most homes, yes. Where do we stand now? There's another Falcon Heavy launch tonight, I believe.
Yeah.
Where do we stand? I mean, we're moving this. I mean, that's amazing. We're moving very quickly. What is the time frame right now, you think?
For Starship?
Yeah. To go to the moon.
It depends. Well, so the FAA said, hold your horses. You know, we gave you a single launch license. We have to renew it. We're going to look into this. So that could take weeks or months. It'll take a matter of months probably to repair the launch pad. He even talked about pulling the one he's building out at Florida, Kennedy Space Center, out to put it up in Texas. That would be a big do. But one way or the other, that's got to be addressed. And then they've got to finish prepping one of the three or four other starships they've got ready to go. And they have more, by the way, in their inventory that are considered out of date, but those could always be retrofitted and flown as well. So he could start launching them in a matter of months and develop quite a flight cadence, which is what he's going to need to get it right. In terms of the moon landing, we've got this to deal with because we need this as the lander, a version of it anyway. And we have the EVA suits to deal with, which are under development now by a company called Axiom. So there's a lot of steps. So 2027, I'm guessing.
2027, says Rod Pyle, host of This Week in Space, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. Go to space.nss.org. Every time.
Never play that again.
Every time. Never. We're going to have a new Space Force theme.
Find enough renditions of Space Force.
I'm going to send you one that somebody tried to submit that I like, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Rod. Right. I love This Week
Thank
in Space.
You.
Everybody should subscribe. Saving the Earth from American scum. Look out. Here we come. Space Force. Thank you.
Team America.
Team America. Thank you, Rod. It's great to have
Take
you.
Take care.
Take
Thanks
care.
So much.
We are Ask the Tech Guys, Leo Laporte, Micah Sargent. You haven't had a chance to ask a thing, so we're going to get to some questions.
Let's do it.
in just a bit. We got to do that. And by the way, I should say, I know it's hard to call. Right now, the way we're doing it is call.twit.tv, which launches a Zoom thing. You could do it on your phone. You could do it on your computer. But I noticed that we're not getting a huge number of calls. So we're talking talking about. We're going
to
have
a phone number. We're very close to getting a phone number. Yeah. Yep.
So that you can just use your phone like you did on the old radio show. I think that will make a big difference. So those of you who are on the line, hang on the line. We're going to get to your calls in just a little bit. And watch in weeks to come, we're going to get a phone number. In the meanwhile, if you don't want to go to call.twit.tv, you can email atg@twit.tv.
Yeah, or ask the tech guy. Pretty busy there, so thank you.
We're getting a lot of good emails. Yeah, and I think it's because it's a little easier. If you want to record a video, that's also a great thing to do. Our show today brought to you by Lookout. Lookout! Lookout. Business has changed forever. You probably have noticed since the pandemic. I'm sorry, Arizona Lou had look. Was going, what? Since the pandemic, people are no longer coming into the office. We're basically a hybrid workforce right now. Half the time, our staff is at home working on stuff in our cloud. Half the time, they're on prem. The boundaries to where we work and how we work have basically just disappeared. And you know what? That's not a bad thing. But it does mean your data is always on the move. I mean, it may be on a device, which an employee is taking home. It might be in the cloud. It might be across networks. Heck, it could be at the local coffee shop at this point. What's, you know, great for your workforce, though, is a challenge for IT security. And that's why Lookout is so important. It helps you control your data and let your workforce be free. Be free, workforce. Fly free. With Lookout, you'll gain complete visibility into all your data so you can minimize risk from both external and internal threats, plus ensure compliance. That's becoming more and more important. And by seamlessly securing hybrid work, your organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity for security. You can let your employees work where they want, as they want. And Lookout makes IT security a lot simpler. Your job gets much easier. Nowadays, you know, many IT departments are frustratingly working with multiple point solutions, legacy tools, trying to get everything to talk to everything else. It's just too complex. And it really reduces your security because there's so much stuff to keep track of. That's where Lookout really shines. With its single unified platform, Lookout reduces that IT complexity, which means you've got more time to focus on, you know, staying secure, any ongoing threat, and also doing the job, innovating, right? Good data protection shouldn't be a cage. It should be a springboard, letting you and your organization bound, boing, toward the future of your making. I think you need to check out Lookout. Go to lookout.com. to learn how to safeguard data, secure hybrid work, reduce IT complexity. That's a lot of benefits with one simple site. Lookout.com. Go there right now and learn more about what Lookout can do for you. We thank Lookout so much for supporting Ask the Tech Guys. We really appreciate that. We also appreciate our club, yeah. Club Twit members. Thank you for supporting us. This show, as you know, as This Week in Space, started with no sponsors, and that means the club footed the bill for the launch, and we wouldn't be here without the club. So thank you, Club Twit members. You got some emails. Why don't we go to the emails? Let's do that.
In fact, we've got a great video question that comes in. Jeremy from Iowa, who wrote in, or actually, I guess, videoed in after Scott Wilkinson joined me as a co-host here on the show a couple of weeks ago. So let's hear from Jeremy from Iowa.
Hi, guys. This is Jeremy in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm primarily a podcast listener, so rather than trying to call in live, I thought I'd send a video question. Last week on the show, Scott Wilkinson was talking about calibrating Leo's new TV and mentioned that the center channel was too high after switching from a 100-inch projection to, I believe it was a 77-inch QD OLED. That was counterintuitive because I would think if the center of the picture was in the same location, the bottom of the smaller screen would be higher, making the center channel too low. Maybe I'm mistaken on that assumption, but I definitely understand needing to have the center channel as close to the bottom of the screen as possible. So it was kind of good timing for a project I'm working on here. So in my front room, I've recently purchased a Samsung Frame TV. And I'm pairing it with a 15-year-old Sony 5.1 system, but I've got the center channel just sitting on the receiver in that little cubby for right now. I was thinking I'd at least set it on top of the console, which is about 6 inches below the bottom of the TV, wondering if it would be even better to mount the center channel to the wall closer to the TV or if top of the console is good enough. I am planning to mount the left and right speakers to the wall beside the TV. I'm thinking I'll probably have the tops of those speakers even with the top of the TV, but was curious if you had any guidelines to follow on that. And then the last part of the question, got the subwoofer just sitting there in the corner. I am planning to pull up the baseboard and run wires to the back for the rear speakers that I'll put up in the corner. And thinking as long as I'm at it, I might as well move the subwoofer back there as well. Don't think the placement of that is critical since it's such a low frequency, but wondering if you had any thoughts on that as well.
Oh, great question.
Yeah, indeed.
And I know a little bit about this. So one thing that confused you is you assumed that I was, like you, going to place the center channel below the speaker, mm-hmm. Below the TV. It's actually above it. So it was right above the edge of the 100-inch screen. But as soon as I replaced that with a smaller screen, there's a difference. Now, there's a reason for that. Lisa didn't want any wires. So we actually had to put wires in the wall, and moving that speaker down would require a significant amount of messing around that I didn't want to do, especially since at some point we'll probably get a bigger screen again, right? The screens are going to get bigger. The other thing I have to point out is I don't notice a difference. So,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. So it's not like suddenly the voices are coming from up there. And this is why it doesn't really matter if you put the center speaker above or below. Your ears are going to adjust and your brain is going to adjust and it's going to say, oh yeah, that's the voice. And it's coming from that guy's mouth. The speaker is never near the mouth. If you think about it, right?
Right. Yeah.
The guy's in the middle of the screen talking, blah, 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 and the speaker's down here.
Yeah.
It's not. So even though there's now a couple more feet than there probably should be for the center speaker above my screen, excuse me, I don't notice any difference at all. It sounds fine to me. So I nobody said anything. In fact, you were in there. I don't know. I can't remember if I showed it to you.
Yeah, you did. And no, I couldn't tell the difference. I wondered if there was going to be because you do have a lot of ceiling above it.
Well, it's ugly. I mean, that's the biggest downside. And I should also point out to our emailer, you should probably turn your couch. Because you're going to be looking over your shoulder. And that's going to screw it all up. Here's the placement situation. You really do want the left and right speakers to be to the left and the right of the screen, but I don't think it matters how close they are either. In fact, it may be that you want more stereo separation, so you place them farther apart than the screen, right?
Okay, yeah.
So you're not worried about left and right being close to the screen. Similarly, center channel can be above or below, obviously, for aesthetics. It should be somewhere that looks, you know, that's not annoying like our center channel. But I don't think from sound point of view, it makes that much difference. Not like you say, well, why is his voice coming from the rafters?
Yeah, I was honestly surprised. I thought it would echo up because you've got a lot of space up there.
Yeah.
But I never noticed anything like that. It sounded...
Now, we also, and Scott didn't say this, he was very kind, but we've also misplaced our surrounds.
Okay.
Your surrounds are not supposed to be behind you. Your surrounds are basically supposed to be at ear level, roughly where your ears would be or slightly in front of.
So if you're sitting on a sofa, it would be on the left and right sides of you.
Yeah, maybe slightly ahead of you, but not much.
Okay.
Okay. You can look at speaker placement guides. For instance, you know, they will say there should be a 60-degree angle between the left.
Oh, my. You can get very
technical. I don't think it makes that much difference. So our surrounds, again, it's because of the nature of the room and where we could put wires in the wall are a little farther ahead of the sofa. Doesn't bother me. In fact, it works so well that sometimes I'll go, what? And then it turs out it wasn't anybody behind me.
In the kitchen talking.
Yeah, yeah. I often hear... it's happened to us many times. Lisa says, there's somebody at the door. I say, no, that's just the stalker who's about to strangle the hero.
Oh, in the show movie. You're watching, yeah.
So I think you can get a little fussy about speakers. Now, the subwoofer, he's right. Also, it doesn't matter where the sub is. I think sometimes you want to put the sub somewhere where it's going to get some, depends how much bass you like, but it's going to get some benefit from bouncing off the walls. So sometimes I like to put a sub in a corner Some people want the sub under the sofa so their butt vibrates. That's all up to you.
It's whatever floats your boat.
But you're right that the ear is better with high, better directional with high frequency sounds. Low frequency sounds, it doesn't really matter where they are in the room.
I want to say something that probably is going to upset some people.
Okay.
I don't really get anything from a subwoofer. It adds nothing to my life.
I would think, because you like dance music, don't you?
I do.
You like music with a good solid bass.
A good solid bass.
Yeah, you're like Megan, what's her name? Megan Trainor. It's all about the bass.
You'd think, right? I guess it's all, so no matter where you place it, that's what's fascinating to me is that it doesn't really, from what we're kind of hearing here, yes, there's an optimal place to place. You're talking about sort of bouncing off areas, but it almost seems like an afterthought in a lot of people's setups. And that's just because it can go anywhere because the frequencies are so low. I guess what I'm saying is I don't understand the subwoofer.
Well, get a nice, you can't because you're in an apartment.
This exactly. Part that's of the problem. Other thing. Yep.
You can't really, but when you move into your own house mm-hmm. and you can really get some good bass, the problem is you don't want the bass to overwhelm the music either, right?
Right.
You don't want to hear the bass. You want to say, oh, wow, that bass is really loud. Is there an elephant in here? You want it to magically mix with the music so the music sounds richer and fuller. So it's to some degree, you're right. If you have good speakers, I'm sure you do, the bass isn't going to be as important. So, you know, the sub isn't going to be as important. But the sub gets those really low frequencies. And if you want a full range stereo sound, you can spend a lot of time adjusting the room position. I wouldn't worry so much about it. I mean, I would if, you know, since you say you're going to put it on top, I would put it on top closer to the screen is probably a better idea. There are some TVs now, Samsung and Sony, I think, make TVs that the speakers are behind the screen and they actually go through the screen. I can't see any difference, to be honest. And we at CES, Scott and I listened to a screen that had speakers behind the screen, and it didn't seem like the center channel was more attuned to the voice than it was when it was slightly above it. I don't think it makes that much difference. It's aesthetically appalling.
Yeah.
And I feel bad about it. So that's all right, because I'm going to use this excuse to get a really big screen someday.
There you go.
Honey, wouldn't it be nice to have a screen that goes all the way up to the center channel?
Now, mounting on the walls instead of using those, what looks kind of like isolating stands, you think it's going to be better to have them mounted on the wall?
No, I think the isolated stands will be better, but you often don't want speakers too close to the wall. Mm-hmm. But again, it's
all subtle, right?
It's very subtle. Yeah. I'm just not sure how important it is to him, given that his sofa is facing that way and the TV is that way. Maybe he plans to move the sofa. Yeah. I certainly hope.
Well, somebody said
my number one recommendation would be face the TV.
Somebody said it looked like that was part of a sectional that wrapped around even more.
Maybe. But then he's sitting too, that screen is way really too small for the distance. Mm-hmm. You want a screen that's going to almost fill your views. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated to get the ideal. And somebody like Scott, who's a perfectionist, is going to have a different point of view than somebody who has to live in the real world.
Yeah, the real world.
Anyway, that's a great, it's a great question. There are, if you Google it, there are lots of articles. Here's one from CNET, how to position your speakers perfectly. This is from 12 years ago, but you know what? Ears haven't changed in 12 years. So, you know, you could look at this, but this is where you're going to start to say, oh, you know, do I really need 60 degrees of separation from my left and right? Do I need to have my speakers between 1 and 2.2 meters from the wall? Do the subs have to be at least 30 centimeters from the corner? By the way, he suggests, which I agree, don't put it in the center of the wall, put it in a corner.
I feel like they are eyesores too. Maybe that's the other thing.
Oh, they're ugly as heck because it's just a big box.
A big box. I can't put a plant on top of it. It'll probably kill the plant.
The other thing I would suggest is it's probably a good idea to get your TV. His TV looked a little high. Mm. You don't want to be looking up at your TV. It's not good for your neck. You don't want to kind of be looking straight across if you can. Lower the TV just a little.
Or raise the sofa.
Raise the sofa. Put everything up on bricks.
On stands.
That way you can put the sub underneath the sofa.
There you go.
You just need a little ladder.
There'll be brick dust everywhere for
It'll
the sub.
It'll be great. It'll be great. Got another email for us?
I do, yes. And I love this question. Oh, we also have a caller in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's do the email. So this is from Tony. Tony writes in, I am renting my cable modem from Cox and it does a decent job, but I hooked up an Orbi 6 to it and I like using the Orbi mesh better. I don't see much, if any, interference. Should I take the plunge and just buy my own modem? My biggest concern is that if I have an internet connection problem, they will blame my modem and not their own connectivity. Other than saving the $10 a month for the rental, is there any other advantage? Thanks, Tony. And I love this question, Tony, because this is actually when I first made the move from using a modem from the company to getting my own. I thought, okay, anytime I ever have a problem, they're just going to say, well, you bought your own hardware, so clearly that's the issue. It has been my experience, though.
They don't do that.
Oh, that's nice. And I was shocked. I mean, they always tell you, have you tried power cycling the modem? Mm-hmm. And they'll even send that little signal through that will automatically power cycle your modem. But they've never gone as... And I've had now 4 different ISPs, and I have genuinely never had that as a problem. I was concerned it would be, but it was not for me, which was great. As Leo has often talked about before, Tony, I think the biggest thing here, the advantage of having your own modem is A, the portability factor. If you ever do plan on moving somewhere else, you've got that modem you can take with you. But B, and I think the most important thing is just as much control as you can possibly have. Let the ISP be the way that you get internet into your home. But then at that point, you get to be in control of how it's working, what it's doing, and have more knowledge kind of about the situation, which I have found often leads to me being able to fix problems without having to contact the ISP. And that has been a big help, because then there are less of those frustrating calls where they're telling you to do the things you already know how to do. It ends up being, it's quite a bit of money that you save. And what I also like is if you're going with the ISP's hardware, there are times where you will get a device that belonged to someone else. And while they're in the process of maybe updating the hardware to newer hardware, you're less likely to get that newer hardware if you're stuck with the old stuff. So as DOCSIS, which I think is currently at 3.1, maybe 3.2 at this point, which is sort of the modem's method of sending and receiving connection and translating that connection into something that can be used for your internet. As that improves, if you've bought your own most recent modem, you've got the best technology possible. And then you can say, no, I've got DOCSIS 3.1. That's not what the problem is here.
So, they want you to have DOCSIS 3.1 because it gives them more control over what you're doing too.
Oh, does it?
So, yeah, I think I have to say I've been really hard on cable companies and ISPs in general for a long time. And I'm going to say that I think they're getting better. I think speeds are going up across the board, and I think reliability has gone up, and I think ISPs are not as draconian as they used to be.
They've had a lot of focus from the government, and I think that has helped. The FCC that had the speed test thing
where you
would get the app, you could do a speed test. And so there's been focus on that to see that companies are holding up to the speeds that they say they will. And then we've seen groups making it so that you don't, I mean, you talked about the rule where if you're not renting the hardware, then you can't be charged for it. And anytime an organization, you know, it's kind of bigger than one company, but ISPs as a whole, anytime some sort of group gets focus and there's regulation coming down the pipe, they will often straighten up and fly right. As my grandpa used to
straighten
say,
up and fly right. That was a song. Did you know that?
Oh, I didn't know that was a song.
That's where it came from.
And so I'm not surprised.
Grandpa's era.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised to see these companies making that choice to kind of try to do right by their customers, because they don't want to face greater, stricter regulations than they already have.
Yeah, maybe they also have realized that. I hope they have. It actually works pretty well if you make customers happy. It's just a weird thing, but they seem to stay customers a little bit longer. All right, we do have now a lot of raised hands. Welcome. It's great to have you all. Let's start with Nick.
Wait, Arizona's on.
Never mind. Hold on, Nick. We'll be right with you. Arizona, Lou. Hello, Lou. You're wearing your prison orange today. That's good.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, I can.
Well, that's amazing, because I went to the dark side.
Uh-oh.
My Windows computer quit. But all you said about the M2,
That's the good side. You went to the bright side, the light side, the Macintosh.
But just so people will know that it's not easy to get through, I tried to call you when I was in Prague on a tour.
Oh, wow.
And then last weekend, I tried to get to you from Atlanta, Georgia, and my phone and my little toy computer were not working. But the next day, I did drive in a Tesla with my cousin down to South Padre Island and watched him sit on the launch pad.
Oh, you didn't get to see it?
And that's all it did.
Oh.
But the next day, we did back up at in Atlanta, we did see the launch of the SpaceX and saw the rapid, unscheduled disassembly.
You've been all over the place since we've talked last, Lou. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
How was Prague? Yeah. Did you enjoy Prague?
Yeah, I did a little show there, and I did about three or four shows in Vienna and a show in Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia.
I'm so impressed. Amazing. And you did them in English, I presume.
Yes.
But they all speak English, so this is the thing that's so embarrassing when you travel. Everybody speaks several languages, English being one of them. And comics can actually work in Europe in English because people laugh. They get they know the language well enough to get the jokes.
Yep.
Blows me away.
My question is about moving to the dark side, or as you said, the bright
side. Come on, yeah. ArizonaLou.com, by the way, for Arizona Lou's, if you want to follow him. And go,
I'm emphasizing on this year's tour. I'm in Florida. I'm emphasizing Florida. And I'm doing...
there's a lot of comedy coming out of Florida lately. You should be... that should be good, ripe for material.
Yeah. What should I know that I don't know about the Mac? Things that I know I don't know are things like a FTP client or server and a text editor for web and coding. And there was something else I needed, but I don't remember what it was.
All right, we're gonna answer both those questions.
Yes.
So I'm gonna tell him get BB Edit.
Yes. And right? I was going to tell him get Transmit.
I agree. Panic Software does Transmit. It's kind of the classic FTP client.
And it does even more than that if you ever end up needing it to. But yes,
FTP. I should also point out, though, you have FTP built into the Mac.
Yes.
Because you have a command line, Lou. And if you know how to use the command line, you can use FTP on the command line just fine. So, but if you want a graphical user interface to FTP, Transmit is easily the best. It's one of the few that's kept up to date because FTP isn't, you know, the hot happening protocol it used to be.
Just to explain to the people that don't know what's going on, that's the way you get your files and pages uploaded to the internet, to FTP.
Yeah, file transfer protocol.
Yep.
And, it, you know, so that's a little old school. Oh, now Mike B is saying that FTP has been removed to terminal, but it does support SFTP, which is actually what you should be using.
Right.
Secure. And that's what Transmit uses, is secure FTP. Now, BB Edit. There you can use it for free. So that's the first thing to know. You don't have to pay for it. And probably everything you need will be available in the free edition. I think BB Edit might even have FTP built.
Have you heard of FileZilla?
Yeah, FileZilla's fine. Nothing wrong with FileZilla.
You don't sound excited about it.
No, it's good.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
That's an open source solution. And so I'm a big fan of it for that reason. Maybe a little more complicated to use. But if you're comfortable with it, it actually may not be because it may look more.
I haven't
warm.
Tried it yet.
Yeah, well, get it. It's free. So it's free, and it's cross-platform, Mac, Windows, and Linux. Yeah, FileZilla is fine. It's, I would say the user interface, as with often is the case with open source projects, is maybe a little obscure. But, you know, if you're using FTP, you're probably used to that anyway. It'd probably be a good choice for you. Certainly look at that first since it's free.
Sure.
Panic Transmit is not. BB Edit is free to use, and then there's a paid tier. I'm betting BB Edit has FTP. I wouldn't.
Yeah, I would think so.
Mm-hmm. So
What about the editing? I use Notepad++.
Yeah, BB Edit That's is better.
Yeah, BB Edit is the choice there. So yeah. Mine was for your FTP question, and BB Edit is your text editor for
barebones.com.
Okay.
And actually, BB Edit does support FTP and SFTP
right in.
Natively in it. So it might be the answer to both questions. You can work on your text. It was what everybody used for websites on the Mac in the early days, but it's still the premier text editor. And it treats an SFTP site just like a local file site. So once you've set up the FTP with a password and login and all that stuff, you just save it. And it'll be just like you're saving it to locally. It's really great.
Of course, I like to test it several times before I send it to the real world.
Of course. So yeah, BB Edit supports SFTP as well as FTP, which is a nice feature. BB Edit's really great.
It's fantastic, feature packed, and it'll do, well, even if you start to get more curious about other stuff, it'll support a lot of that as well.
Have a text editor, a notepad-like text editor built into the Mac, which is Text Edit, but it saves as rich text format by default. So
yeah, and it probably doesn't color code the tags.
Oh, it doesn't do any of that. Yeah. No. Yeah. BB Edit will. If you want another choice that's free, from Microsoft, VS Code is available on the Mac platform as well as Windows and Linux. It's free, and it also does that color coding for HTML. And it supports HTTP as FTP as well, come to think of it. So VS Code, which is short for Visual Studio Code, is Microsoft's quasi-open source code editor. I say quasi because, yes, part of it's open source, but you want to do anything with it, you're going to need to use the closed source part. It's not Visual Studio. It's Visual Studio Code. Visual Studio is not free, but you can get VS Code from visualstudio.com.
Okay. Well, hey, I appreciate it. And I want to give you greetings from north of Miami, Florida.
Nice.
Wednesday, I'll be doing a show for veterans in Key West, Thursday, Key Largo, and Friday, Homestead, Florida. And then I'll up for you can see my schedule online.
Yeah, ArizonaLou.com. And he donates all proceeds to the Alzheimer's Foundation, which is really a nice thing to do.
If I remember.
Thank you, Arizona Lou.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Lou. Have a great congratulations on what must have been an amazing tour. That's what a success. Yeah. That's great.
Hey, thanks a lot. You guys are great.
Take care. Bye, Lou.
Bye, Lou.
Wow. Bye, Lou. I'm impressed.
I know. Wow. Traveling all over doing comedy
shows.
He's
a traveling guy. Let's do another call, and then I will cross over and show you some Raspberry Pi tricks. Kelly is on the line. Kelly, welcome to Ask the Tech Guys. This is why we don't have a clock with seconds on here. Because then when we do the edit, you won't notice.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Kelly.
Hello, Kelly.
Welcome. Join us in the Stargate, if you will. What's up?
Oh, just audio.
No video. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. We don't mind. We'll just leave this up. Brother, yeah,
you bet. Thank you.
Sure.
Hey guys, I'm a big history fan, and Leo, one of the things I appreciate about your network is that, you know, it has a history of all your shows that I can go and reflect and watch and everything.
Thank
and
you.
I also watched the old Stuart Chaffee's
Computer Chronicles. Shows. Yeah,
the Computer Chronicles, and it's just such a joy to reminisce and remember and everything like that.
You're obviously been around a while because Micah probably doesn't remember.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was kind of refreshing myself on the Kildall story and everything.
Yeah, Gary Kildall. Who created the first DOS for PCs, DR DOS, Digital Research.
Yeah, the man who could have been Bill Gates.
Yeah. Lore goes, although I think some deny it, that when IBM came calling, the first place they went was Digital Research down in Monterey. But Gary was up in his private plane and couldn't be bothered to meet with them. So they went on up to Seattle and made a deal with Bill Gates instead.
Oh.
I don't think that's exactly, I think that might be apocryphal, but it's a great story anyway. Yeah. And he did miss out. Yeah.
But thank you for your rich history and everything. And I always watch the Stuart Chaffee episode that you did with triangulation and everything, just to remember.
Stuart's a legend.
My question for you is that, can you give me any kind of recommendations on movies or documentaries that you enjoy that kind of bring nostalgia back to computers and stuff.
I'll tell you one I just watched last night. It's on Apple TV Plus. It's Tetris.
Oh yeah.
What a great Now at first I thought this is terrible. I'm watching it. It's the story of Tetris. And you and I think you probably remember this as well as I do. When Tetris first emerged, it was the most addictive game ever. But it emerged in a weird way. It was on the PC, and then it was on an arcade, and then it was the big hit was when it got onto the Game Boy. The story of how it got there is insane. It is wild. And they've made a really good movie about Hank Rogers, who was a programmer, a coder. He'd grown up in Holland, of Indonesian background, lived in the United States, met his wife and married in Hawaii, then moved to Japan with her because she was Japanese, and coded one of the very early Japanese video games, PC video games. But then went to CES and saw Tetris. And as a coder, as a gamer, as a guy who knew games, he said, this is huge, and goes on an amazing quest, ending up in the Soviet Union to find the guy who wrote it, Alexei Pajitnov, and to secure the rights for it. And it is quite a story. So that is one I highly recommend. I think just came out on Apple TV. I interviewed Alexei Pajitnov, the creator of Tetris, some years later. Hank made enough money, got him out of the Soviet Union with his family. They moved to the United States. Alexei told me, he said, yeah, all I got paid by the Soviets for Tetris and the rights to Tetris was a brand new PC. He said, but given that the PCs that we were using in the Soviet Union were so horrible, I was really happy. He's made more money since then. And it's a really great story. So that's one. There's one on YouTube I've recommended on this show before called BBS. Now that's really going back in time. And it's a long a documentary. It's broken up into several parts on YouTube. Highly recommend that. This is one for old timers like us, because it's got, you know, reminiscences about things that I think a lot of people will have long ago forgotten. Things like the Zip Wars. but that was a fantastic documentary. Highly recommend that.
Micah, question for Micah. Is there anything, any stories that you've seen lately around tech that you enjoyed that has inspired your younger generation?
So this is the thing. When I was getting off the ground in terms of my interests, I originally went to school to be an advertising person. I wanted to go work for an ad agency and do graphic design and that kind of thing. And so there are three documentaries that I want to mention that I think can be helpful for and interesting to anyone who exists in this sort of interest in mechanics and technology and how it all kind of works together. And they're all made by the same group. There's a documentary called Helvetica, and it's about
love that
the history. I used to fall asleep to that film every night.
What a great, so you would good. Think, I mean, this is the most boring font ever.
Right.
And you would think, well, that's gotta be the most boring documentary ever. Oh,
it's
no.
It's so good. It is so good. And then, so it talks about the history of graphic design in general, but also typefaces. You get some time with Dieter Rahms. It's amazing. And then there's also Objectified. And that is a documentary about product design and manufacture. And it is super incredible. And there's a third one. The name itself escapes me, but it's about city planning. And I learned so much about human nature from that documentary that I was not expecting, based on the story of how people plan different cities and how they're put together. And it's, again, made by the same team that made Helvetica and Objectified. I think anyone who has an interest in just learning things in general and is a tinkerer at heart, which I think a lot of tech people are, would get so much out of those three films. Start with Helvetica, check out Objectified next, and then go to the city planning documentary after that. They're so good.
Since you said three, I'll do one more to make mine three. Triumph of the Nerds. Have you ever seen that?
I have not seen
it. Goes way back. It stops like where we would consider ancient history, because it was made a long time ago, but another great one. There's also, someday we should go over great books about this. But those are six documentaries that it sound like they'd be well worth. And actually, Tetris is dramatized, so I shouldn't call that a documentary, but it'd be well worth seeing.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Great question, Kelly. I didn't ask you. I didn't get to ask you where you're calling from.
Brooklyn.
Nice.
Awesome. Brooklyn. Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. That's a great one.
You bet. And you know, if your listeners have any other ideas and everything, I'm listening. I love filling my head with the good documentaries.
Good. Throw them in. You can throw them into our IRC at irc.twit.tv. If you're in the club, Club Twit Discord, you could throw them in there too. There's actually already a number of really good links. Scooter X put one from Make Use Of, which is 10 amazing documentaries explaining the birth of computers in the internet, that also has some additional recommendations. I'd add, I'd concur with their mother of all demos. If you
know. Oh, the mother of all demos. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Oh my.
One of the things that's really been a privilege for me doing this show for so many years, since 1992, I think, is that I've gotten to interview and meet many of the people who were involved
at
the beginning of the world. And I remember when Doug Engelbart, who was the guy who did the mother of all demos, came into the Screensavers and brought that wooden mouse, the very first mouse, the mouse prototype, with him.
Wow.
And I was in awe of the man and the mouse. Really an amazing story. So that's worth watching too. That's on YouTube as well. The mother of all demos. Kelly, a pleasure. It's fun to go down memory lane with another long-time user.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to now have to stand up.
Stand up.
See how well I can do that. Because we've talked so much about the Raspberry Pi over the years. It's really impressive. I've even interviewed the creator of the Raspberry Pi on triangulation. And so, you know, we've talked about with people like Adafruit about, you know, projects and stuff, but I don't know if we've really covered it
from the get-go.
So let's do a primer, a beginner's introduction to the Raspberry Pi. I'm going to get up and walk over.
I often feel this is what's missed in reviews. And when we talk about products is getting people started.
People assume, you know, everything. And we do that all the time. In fact, I think that's fine because we don't want to be, you can't always be a beginner's guy, but every once in a while you want to talk about it. This is an old Raspberry Pi. A lot of us, it's hard to get the new Raspberry Pi, to be honest with you. A lot of us have old Raspberry Pis we bought lying around for various projects. John, I know, how many do you have? 5 Raspberry Pis doing a lot of audio stuff in your house, switching and controls and stuff like that. These are basically inexpensive, tiny little computers. This is a $35 computer. It has an ARM microprocessor on it. But the thing that makes the Raspberry Pi so cool, and the creators of this really were inspired by something called the BBC Micro, which was an inexpensive computer in the 80s that a lot of British kids learned about computers from. It was a very popular school computer, very popular in the home. It was kind of their version of the Commodore 64. So the creator of the Raspberry Pi, as many Brits did, grew up with that and said, we should have something for the modern generation that's inexpensive, that's easy, that they can learn about computing with. And he created the Raspberry Pi, and it has been a huge hit. Hard to get right now because of the chip shortage. That's starting to ease up. This is a Raspberry Pi 3B, but they're up to 4 now. But here's what makes the Raspberry Pi cool. Yeah, $35, but it also has I/O. So this one has 4 USB ports. It has a Ethernet jack. How about that? In fact, I might need an Ethernet jack, John. I won't need it yet. For the next one, we will. It has HDMI out. It has audio out. But the thing that really makes the Raspberry Pi interesting is this. It has they call it the GPIO. It has a I/O bus that you can connect to. So you can connect this to a variety of hardware components, make it do a lot of things. You can actually use it as a full computer. It has RAM. It has a processor. You put storage in an SD card. So it has a little SD card slot right here. In fact, micro SD. So here's a 32 gig inexpensive micro SD card. You'll put the operating system on here. And Raspberry Pi comes with its own version of Linux. They used to call it Raspbi, and now they just call it Raspberry Pi OS. You put it in just in that slot in here. And now that's the memory. It's also the operating system. That's your hard drive. So it's got everything you'd want for a computer. People often, in fact, I can power it. I will power it with this micro USB. I wonder if the new Raspberry Pis, I haven't seen one, have type C. I think they may still have micro USB. You can boot it up with just by plugging in. You obviously got to put the operating system in. It'll run it'll even run Windows. There's a version of Windows for Raspberry Pi. In fact, there's a wonderful book on learning to program Python on the Raspberry Pi that uses that version of Windows, because that Windows has Minecraft on it. Okay, I'm not putting it in right, I guess. It's not going in fully. That version of Windows has Minecraft on it, which Microsoft owns, plus an API that allows you to control it with Python. So here, you know, you want to get your 12-year-old or 11-year-old or maybe even a smart 10-year-old into computing, and they love Minecraft, get a Raspberry Pi with get this book, Learning to Program Python with Minecraft. It's from No Starch Press. And you can put Windows on here, and you can run Minecraft on here and a Minecraft server on here, and you can program it. And they'll very quickly learn Python because it's so much fun to blow up things in Minecraft. So I'm going to plug this in and show you how it works. But first, let's tell you what the project is for today, because most of the time, you could use this, by the way, you could totally use this with a keyboard, mouse, and monitor, and it would be a computer. Not the fastest computer in the world, but for a kid, a fine computer. But you remember the other day, just before I left on vacation, I got this. This is an e-ink display from Pimaroni. It's called the Inky Impression, and this is a 7.3-inch, 800x480-pixel display. It's 7-color e-ink. Probably not fast enough. The refresh rate on this is probably not fast enough to use it as your display. And there are plenty of displays you can buy that are normal displays that you could put on. But this is what's called a hat. They call it a hat because you can put it on top of the Raspberry Pi. You can mount it on the Raspberry Pi. I'm going to show you how to do this. Most Raspberry Pis, if you get a kit, will come with a variety of different adapters. In this case, the one we're going to use is not a cable. See that this matches exactly the GPIO bus. This matches exactly the pins on the Raspberry Pi. The problem is we can't get it quite on there enough. I've got these standoffs in here. Let me take the standoffs off because those will also come with the kit. So we can start completely from scratch. You could try to put this on there, but you're going to see, oh, it's too thick. Well, that's why you have this. This is a little standoff. It's just another one, right? It plugs into here, pushes into there, and then it's just the right depth that the Raspberry Pi, when plugged into the standoff, let me do this right. You're going to want to do this more carefully than Leo is, and you're probably going to want to ground yourself and all that stuff, right? But Leo's, as you know, a risk taker. And now this is mounted as part of, this could be a single unit. You could hang this on the wall, for instance. But there's one problem. There's a lot of flexing that's going to go on. So before I do that, I'm going to put those things that I took off back. And again, if you go to Adafruit or RaspberryPi.com or one of many project sites, they'll sell this all as kits. They'll sell a regular display if you want. These are the standoffs that come with it. And notice, The Inky is designed for this. It's got three screw holes in exactly the right position for the Raspberry Pi. This is why you want to get stuff designed for Raspberry Pi, because that makes it very easy. So,
and they always expected that you would kind of use this as a singular unit, because I'm noticing you're taking up all of those GPIO pins. So it's not as if you could put something else.
Yeah. You could, though, connect something into this using the USB.
USB, yeah.
Right. So the Raspberry Pi is very programmable. I won't put all four in there. There's a fourth standoff that you could put there. These things, so now when I put this back into the extender there like that, those match exactly the holes on the Raspberry Pi, and I can screw this in. Now this thing is integral to the screen. I mean, it's as if it was built into it. So this allows you to upgrade, to change Raspberry Pis. It allows you to play with it. You don't have to, it's a part of it. It's secure. And now we're ready to go. So I could power up this Raspberry Pi, plug it into a keyboard, mouse, and monitor, and I would have a full computer, and it's running this inky impression. The next step we're going to save for next week, which is to program it. So we're going to go to raspberrypi.com, and we're going to get the Raspberry operating system. You get it for the one that you're using, in this case, the Raspberry Pi 3B. We'll get the right operating system. It'll actually boot up into that operating system. And then it comes with Python installed. Python is really kind of the default language. You can write for the Raspberry Pi with a variety of different languages, but Python usually has the libraries you need. In this case, the folks at Pi Moroni who make the Inky provide a Python library that gives you a full interface to these pins on here.
Oh, right? Nice.
So it makes it very easy. So they give you example. All I really need is an example program in Python that will display a picture on here. They give us that. They call it logo.py, but we're going to modify it because in order for this to do what we want it to do, which is, I think, be a clock. We'll see if it refreshes. It has to refresh at least once a second. I think we can do that. Ink displays are notoriously slow. That's why you can't use them as a regular display. But if I could even get it once a second to, if it can get it to update once a minute. If we want a second hand, I'll have to do it once a second. If we just want it to be by the minute, like our other clock, once a minute, we for sure can do that. Then we can make this into a 7-color display that's a little bit more controllable. The cool thing on this inky impression is it has 4 buttons, A, B, C, and D, and their library will also allow us to query those buttons and respond to those buttons. So we're going to have a library that lets us talk to the screen, display stuff on the screen, see the state of the buttons, know when a button is pressed, and respond to it. The library I'm going to use is very simple. All it does is displays an image on the drive. That's this little micro SD card. It displays an image on the drive on the screen. So the second part of the program will be to create that image, update it once a minute. If it's a clock, every minute will change the minute hand, that kind of thing. So that's going to be in our next stage. But that's kind of how it works. And if you go to adafruit.com, you'll see they have a variety of kits. I think there's still a short supply on pies, which is a little frustrating because this is the greatest little thing. $35 for the bare bones Raspberry Pi. Add a couple of bucks for an SD card. The kit may have many of these things. You're going to add a couple of bucks for other parts, for a screen. You probably have an old mouse and keyboard lying around that you can use. They'll just use the USB ports on here. Ethernet is nice, but it will also support Wi-Fi. So the later Raspberry Pis will also support Wi-Fi. So you're really set with a computer system. We'll do the second part of the project. We'll get into Python. We'll get into the little coding in weeks to come so that we can turn this into a little bit of a clock. There you go. That's part two, because I showed you before I left the inky impression. Now we got a Raspberry Pi firmly attached to it. I brought the battery pack because you can use a battery pack to power it up. I'll just show you real quickly. I'll just plug it in. I hate micro USB.
Yeah, the newer one has USB-C as
its power. It does. Hallelujah.
Confirmed.
Hallelujah. Although, you know, it's not a big deal. We got the lights. It's starting to boot up. It will handle the Ethernet network. It'll handle an HDMI device. It has sound built in. It's kind of amazing what you get for $35 these days. All right, I'm going to walk back over. That's it on the on part one of our clock, our new clock for the set. I'm going to walk back over to the set, and we're going to take another call. What do you say, Micah?
Sounds great.
When I did call for help in Canada, we had a really kind of limited set, and it was a tiny little room. It's all Rogers gave us, and they barely managed to get 3 cameras in there. And there was a big pole in the middle of the set, and every single show, I had to open the show and then make this transition walking around this pole. And the poor camera guy had to kind of follow me around the pole. Never really worked right. So we have the same problem here, which is that demo set is a mile away. It's a long way away. Before we go to our next call, and I think it will be, looks like I see a hand raised from Chris in Miami. I do want to do a little shout out to our sponsor. Do you mind?
Beautiful.
May I?
You may.
It's actually an important sponsor to us because without it, there would be no Twit. You know, back in the earliest days when we started the podcast, I just put it up on a website. And then I quickly learned that there are very few websites that can handle 55 to 100,000 downloads all at once. So we were trying BitTorrent and all sorts of things. Then a guy named Matt Levine called me. He was the founder of a content delivery network, a CDN called CacheFly. And Matt said, we can help. And the rest is history. Without CacheFly, there would be no Twit. CacheFly is a CDN, a content delivery network that makes sure your content, whether it's a podcast, a game, a website, gets to your customers faster and easier. Customers, as you know, are impatient. They're not going to wait around for your content to load. So if you're taking too long to load, they're going to go. You can dramatically increase your sites and apps speed over long distances for global audiences the same way we did with CacheFly. Now more than 3,500 clients in over 80 countries around the world. Organizations like Twit consistently use CacheFly. Why? Because it scales. Whether a million people download a show or five, CacheFly can handle that content. It's reliable. We've never in all these years, must be 15 years, had a problem with CacheFly. If there's been a problem, it's always on our side. CacheFly is there for us. An unrivaled performance, because when you download our shows, when you download a game, an app, a website from CacheFly, you're downloading it from a server that's near you. With over 50 points of presence all over the world, it means CacheFly is nearer to your customers, to our listeners. Now, I have to say, some markets are more challenging than others. And content delivery costs can really vary drastically. So you want to work with a CDN. We had to. We're not rolling in it. You have to work with a CDN that knows what it takes to deliver content fast. We do want a global market. We want you to be able to listen anywhere in the world and is honest about how much it's going to cost to get you there. Plus, you want a CDN that'll scale your content delivery in markets that are tough. CacheFly, for instance, has been building points of presence in South and Central America. This is going to be a huge market for gaming and entertainment over the next 5 years. We know already we're seeing incredible growth in South and Central America. CacheFly is committed to helping you navigate the complex government attitudes, the tariffs, and the laws so that they understand how the market operates so that you can work in that market. Of course, Asia Pacific IP traffic is growing too, 25% year over year. That includes Australia. Because of, a couple of things. Australia's a big continent, right? Spread out. Lack of early investment in the region. It's been very difficult to cover the entire Australian continent. Well, guess what? CacheFly has presence in Melbourne, Perth, and Sydney on the east and in the west. So it's not a problem to get to your customers in Asia Pacific. India, too. Huge market. Fastest growing consumer economy. Big on mobile content consumption. Many business operations tied to the West. You get edge optimized content tailored to the mobile market and dedicated transfer and caching solutions with CacheFly in the Indian market. They're there, which is where you want to be, right? Reach your audience anywhere in the world. CacheFly, 50 plus points of presence all over the world. Ultra low latency video streaming that can handle more than a million customers. Lightning fast gaming. Zero lag, glitches, or outages. Mobile content optimization that delivers automatic and simple image optimization so your site will load faster no matter what size device it's on. Plus, you don't ever have to worry about service overlap again. You'll get flexible month-to-month billing for as long as you need it. Discounts for fixed terms once you're happy. You design your own contract. We did, and we've been very happy when you switched to CacheFly. Since 1999, CacheFly has been building trusted CDN relationships. We've been with them for almost the whole time we've been around. There's no better CDN. I want to recommend CacheFly to everybody. It's the only CDN built for throughput, delivering rich media content 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods, 30% faster than other major CDNs. You can learn how to get your first month free when you go to CacheFly.com. How many years have I been saying this? CacheFly. .com. CacheFly. Thank you, CacheFly. We really appreciate the support. All right. Caller number three is Chris in Miami, my coffee man. Hello, Chris. I don't know if Chris will agree. Best coffee I ever had, Chris.
Rome. Where?
Rome, Italy.
I saw that.
Rome, Italy.
I saw the coffee. That coffee bar, I was like going into a meltdown when I saw this coffee bar. he takes this picture and I'm like, oh, the angels are singing.
Oh, it was so good.
And I was
good.
Like, what? Yeah, I thought I sent you a message on that.
Yes, I did. I saw it. We were in Rome and our guide said, well, we have to go to the oldest coffee shop in Rome, Tazzadoro. And oh, my God. She showed it. Also, she said, Romans never sit down to drink coffee. No. In fact, you have to pay an extra price if you want to sit down.
Really? Table fee.
She said, we just stand at the counter and drink it because we're in a hurry. Out, and it's espresso. It's the best espresso I've ever had. And she says, I like to have it with a little bit of cold milk. So I say, con latte frio. And that little cold milk, you pour it in there. Just a dab. You're not going to make a cappuccino or a latte out of it. That's unheard of afternoon. Do you drink your coffee straight, Chris?
I drink my coffee black all the time. Even when I use the coffee press, it's always black. I don't like anything in my coffee.
That's what they say.
We're not doing that.
Real coffee lovers don't adulterate their coffee with other
things. Exactly what it is. No adulterating in Miami. Well,
no.
Not in my coffee cup.
Not in the cup anyway.
There you go.
Yeah. Mike is the same way, right? You don't want to mess around with your coffee.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah. He loves his coffee. I'm going to pull up those pictures of Tazzadoro so we can look at them after you tell us what your question is, Chris.
Well, I wanted to start off by saying welcome back.
Thank you.
To the party.
Thank you.
Missed you absolutely bunches. You know, Micah was a party.
We did pretty well. In fact, the best we've ever done, frankly, which encourages me to take more time off. I hope you're ready for it because I think we've got such great people with Micah and Jason and Ant and all the people who came in like Scott Wilkinson. I just feel like we're in great shape. Rosemary Orchard.
Yeah.
Man, if I could get her to move.
Rosemary came over.
If I could get her to move here, we'd hire her in a heartbeat.
He was happy. He's like, woohoo, Rosemary's in the house. It was like a party.
It was a party. It was. We had a party.
Yeah. She's the host with Micah of iOS Today, which is a great show that's every Tuesday.
Absolutely amazing. But you were missed. So I know you
want
to go away all the time, but you were missed.
I won't go away all the time.
Maybe just Miami. I don't know.
Only in Miami am I missed. Hey, I want to go. I want to do like Arizona Lou. I want to go to Key West and do the shows.
Oh, you were just over here, like late last year or something?
A couple of years ago before the pandemic. Oh, yeah. We went down to the Caribbean. We went to Cancun, which was wonderful. We love it. But yeah, I wouldn't mind doing the Keys, the Florida Keys. As long as there's no hurricane, I think that'd be fun.
You come to Miami, you know, my hubby, he worked at Sushi Siam on Key Biscayne, so that's a comp meal.
And
for
I love South Beach. South Beach is beautiful. Yeah. It's fun. So what can we do
South
for
Beach
you?
South Beach is mixed. Well, you know, I still, South Beach.
I like the pastel. I like the pastel building. That's what I like. I just think that's pretty.
It is pretty.
Yeah.
It is pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm still working on I got the Apple Watch Ultra.
Oh, good. See, gorgeous.
There it is. But the bands are very easy to use. It's not a problem. But I did check out Nomad, and the titanium one that I wanted to get is $300. It's on back order. Apple's stainless steel one, I don't know what people are talking about, but it's not. I know I work out and everything. I mean, but it's not heavy, people. It really, it adds a couple of minor ounces to it. People explain it in videos like, you put on the stainless steel to the watch and your arm hits the floor. That doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. So,
well, tell me, here, I'll let an independent judge. I'm wearing this is the Ultra, which is a heavy watch with that titanium band. And I had to wait a few months to get it from Nomad Goods. Tell me if you feel like that's heavy.
Of course, with titanium, titanium's lighter
pretty lean.
Stainless steel. I don't notice a difference.
You don't notice anything. Yeah, but people are talking about in videos like you put it on and it's like
it's a little heavier.
Or it's too heavy.
Sorry, it's part of the workout. You know, I got muscles.
Yeah. When you take it off, your arm just flies up in the air.
I don't know if you're like me, so I'm getting up. I'm still in my jammies. I'm going to row for a little bit. And I said, wait, I can't row. Lisa can't says, row come on, row.
Yep.
She said, can't row. I don't have my watch. I went and got my watch and put it on.
Get your.
I want credit.
Steps. Yeah, exactly. Credit. Thank you.
If I don't get credit, it didn't happen. Watch or it didn't happen.
Yeah. That's,
anyway,
I did go to the Nomad site.
I think it's pretty pricey. $300. I think a lot of people would be a little put off by that. The steel band is less, $200. I think Nomad makes really nice products. They used to be a sponsor. If you really want light, I guess they have aluminum. But since this Ultra is titanium, you know, in its body, I think it matches very nicely. Nice. It's got a lot of times third party watches don't have good clasps. This has a very nice clasp. It's both magnetic and physical. I don't know. I'm pretty happy with it.
I don't think you'd wear just anything, Leo. You're wearing particular.
Right now, you've got the sweatpants of Apple Watch bands on, the hook and loop.
It's, you know what, but it's very easy to use. I mean, at first I was like, okay, but I got to tell you, it doesn't get dirty. It matches the closest thing. I miss my Milanese loop though. I like my Milanese loop, but maybe they'll come out with other bands. I don't mind going with a link bracelet. I've always had a link bracelet actually on all my watches until I came to Apple. And then I've been doing the Milanese loop for a number of years now, but this is very easy. The green I don't like. I don't like the green, and I don't want the orange because God forbid everybody else in the room has orange.
Yeah,
so I don't want to do orange. So the titanium looks good. You know, it's $300 at Nomad, and then it's $49 more for the stainless steel over at Apple. So
titanium,
if $300 is too much,
is about titanium. 40% lighter than stainless steel. Mm. So if you're looking for lighter,
I'm happy with this. But I have a lot of bands. I wear a leather band sometimes.
Yeah.
I wear that Velcro, hook and loop sport band. As Rene Ritchie calls it, the sweatpants. This is, by the way, a picture of us ordering. Okay. So when you go to Rome to get your coffee, you got to understand that you go to these coffee shops. I got a picture up here. You go first to the cashier and you tell them what you want. Then you get a slip of paper that says what you want. And there we are giving it to the barista. So he doesn't touch money, right? You pay the cashier and then you give the slip to the barista. He's getting his €1 tip. And this is very important when you're standing up. There's Lisa. When you're standing up, you talk with your hands as you're having your delicious espresso. There's the machine. That machine is the biggest espresso machine I ever saw. It had six heads on it.
That's
impressive.
It was. I was wondering if it's a long wait or not.
And
three cups easy. Right there.
There you go. Three cups easy.
It's so, I have to say, so good.
That's awesome.
I'm jonesing.
Yeah, but you know what? I think you had some people that really were like, you know, why is he on vacation? What's he doing? And you know,
I'm
glad.
How dare he be on vacation? Well, no, can now because we've got Micah, Ant, Jason. We've got people. I got people.
You got people.
That's why we got people.
Well, 19 years, man. 19 years of doing the right thing.
And pandemic,
there was one episode.
And then pandemic, we didn't really get a lot of vacation time. So we're kind of making up for it. But I have to say, we don't have any others planned. So I'll be here for the rest of my life.
Well, because, you know, you had one episode where it had to do with Dickie D when I think it was back in the day with this fella didn't want to work. And you said, you got to check with me first. And I sent it to you, actually. And then you're like, well, God forbid you work a full day. And then you did the eye roll, which I thought was perfect because it's like, God forbid you work a full day. God forbid you work a full day. 19 years of full days. You got to start over again.
I don't work that hard now. I'm retirement age.
I know.
And I work 3 days a week. That's a good life for me.
That's good for you.
Yeah.
You can be on vacation for the other days of the week.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to ask, I talked to Micah about this. I think you were here before about the doorbell ring thing. I'm still kind of going through that. I wanted to maybe get a couple of cameras. And I find that it's not the cost. I can go to Best Buy, maybe pick up something, but I'm just still kind of going through that. And Micah, you were very helpful before, you and Leo, but I'm still kind of going phasing in and out of this where if I get something, I want to make sure. For me, really, it's the camera. I want a camera that sees down to the floor, out, and that, you know, to the roof. I live in a condo, so I want to see what's going on out there when someone's knocking on my door. But I also want to have some stuff in my house in the corners and cameras and everything. And so that's really just the reason for the you can do it however you want it. You can get back in touch with me whenever you want. But that's kind of like where I'm at right now on that.
I will
that's
say
my question and everything. So
just for anyone who's asking, you're hard pressed at this point to find any of the mainstream makers of these smart cameras. You're hard pressed to find any that kind of fail at
doing what you
want them to do. Yeah, because we've reached sort of parity between the different companies. So I think in the end, it's all about who you want to do business with and where your comfort level is, because Amazon is working on it with their Ring stuff. Google is working on it with their Nest stuff. Then you've got those third party companies, Wyze and Eufy. And of course, those companies have had their share of issues with security. And so I hesitate to recommend any brand in particular at this point, because it all depends on what your own decision is, on your sort of limitations that you have. I have a Wyze camera that I simply just plug in when I leave the home and use it then. And it's this great pan. They remade their pan camera. So now it's on version 3, and it's fantastic. It has the auto smarts to follow along if there's something that's moving in the frame, and you can take control of it yourself. It doesn't cost a whole lot of money, which is also great. And it plugs in, it can be mounted anywhere. And even though Wyze had its set of security issues, and you know, there was kind of the back and forth there, for me and my comfort level, I don't have this camera on or even plugged in whenever I'm at home. And even a lot of times when I'm gone, I don't have it's whenever I'm gone for a longer period of time, then it plugs in. So for me, I'm okay with the issues that they had in the past that they addressed and worked on. And the same applies to Eufy for the same reason. So yeah, it all really depends on what you feel comfortable having inside your home and how much money you're wanting to spend. If it's at the low end, you might check out Wyze if you're comfortable with them. And if you kind of want to go up from there, that's where you would look at Amazon's Ring or Google's Nest as an option.
What about security? Oh, sorry, Leo.
Yeah, Ben. I have the Hello.
First, Leo.
I have the Hello, the Google Nest. Pretty happy with it. Security is one thing, privacy is another. I think those are the two things you should ask yourself about when you get one of these.
Absolutely.
And I trust Google's security pretty much. So I think it's fairly safe. But remember, in most of these, you are storing the videos on their website. So the Nest website has full-time video of wherever I have a camera, including my front door. If I have a camera in the house, in the house, and I do. That's so you can go look at it at any time. That's a convenience, but you better trust A, that they're keeping it secure so somebody else can't see it, and B, that they're not, you know, misusing it for their own purposes.
Right.
Security and privacy, they go hand in hand, really. Right.
Yeah.
I guess Wyze would be, I mean, they've had security issues, but they do have a camera where you don't send it to the
cloud. Yes. Almost all of their cameras actually come with a micro SD slot. Including that Pan V3 that I was just talking about. And so you don't have to...
You can record locally.
Yeah, you can just record it locally.
That has its disadvantages. Mm-hmm. And of course, Wyze had a problem with their first version of their camera that was cracked, and they haven't been able to fix it.
Don't use the first version.
You had the first version of camera, some stranger could log into your cameras. That's not good.
Exactly. What about the concern.
Google. Google has this tendency. I was listening to Rich on Tech on Saturday, it was. And apparently, it seems like every weekend, maybe. I think it's every weekend, every week. Google keeps removing products that they don't want anymore. So they just removed something else recently. And so I was looking to get into Google and more of their product line, because we have their routers around our condo already. But they just seem to say, we're going to delete that. We're not going to have that product no longer. We're just going to move on. Let's maybe try something new. So it seems like there's no sense of that they're going to be around for a while. They just seem to just say, well, let's discontinue the first set of routers and you can go out and spend $600 on maybe three more, which I don't mind doing, but that's not a really good security thing for me, is what Google does. They do what they want.
Right. And that's the unfortunate aspect. And that's the thing. I don't know that this reputation that they've gotten from that is something that I think they would want to continue to try to fix. And I think the problem is we do tend to look at Google as this sort of monolith of a company. And oftentimes it's these smaller teams that are making these different products. And within those teams, there are decisions to close this down or close that down. But from the outside, it's like, oh, Google is shuttering this. Google is shuttering this. Google is shuttering this. Mm-hmm. All of those companies were broken out. It wouldn't look as if it's as frequent as it is. And so, yes, there is a concern about the lack of trust there, that the product will last in the long term. The same thing applies to Amazon in terms of privacy. There's a narrative surrounding Amazon that they are constantly scooping up data. And in many cases, you do see that, but they have I have to give them credit for this. They have made significant improvements to your control over how much data they collect, how they collect it, how long they hold on to it. There are little settings that you can say, I don't want you to ever save this to your server. And so they have made those improvements, but the narrative is still there. So that applies for Google in terms of closing things down. That applies to Amazon in terms of the privacy aspects.
Well, the irony is Amazon also closes things down.
Yes, this is true.
I bought one of their Amazon, what do they call those? Halo bands that are a health band. They just closed that down. So look, this can happen to big companies and little companies. Little companies can go out of business. I had a dash cam the owl cam that went out of business. I mean,
it's the risk, unfortunately.
That's always the risk. I think you're probably at less risk buying a product from Google, given that they're not going to go out of business anyway.
Right.
And I think when they kill products, they do it with enough warning and so forth. But there's always that risk that that doorbell in, you know, what do you expect? Do you think that doorbell will be working in 10 years? I doubt it. You know, you're probably going to want, even if Google doesn't go out of business or kill the Nest line, you're going to want a newer doorbell. Because when you're, once you start putting smart products in your home, stop thinking that's going to last forever. You're going to be upgrading them. So
yeah, I'm not one of those people. I have to be right up minute to the, you know, the next cup of coffee.
With a doorbell, you're
not one of those people.
You're
though.
Not so much invested in the long, you're not going to look at those videos 5 years from now. It's not, it's not like a photo storage type, right? So you're not so much invested in having a continuity of service. If they go out of business, you get a new one. I don't think that's the end of the line.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I don't think that's the end of the line.
No. Just, you know, and a lot of times too, a lot of products, I mean, it's like the whole iPhone thing, the smartphone thing where people have their phone for like 10, 12 years. And I'm like, I mean, I got a friend of mine like that in Texas.
Oh, I know.
Like, you know, it'd be a good idea to update the phone because it's no longer made. Are they even supporting it? When the software goes off the grid, if I actually keep something that long, then that's it for me. I mean, literally, it's got to be game over because now everything goes with it. And I basically don't have a brick, but it's like people just, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but I mean, I have the 14 Pro, I have the Apple Watch Ultra, and I might sell the 14 Pro. I like it, but if they make another leap, I'm a little weird like that. But I mean, I just don't keep things you're not going to have me keep a panel for 10, 12 years. Right. And then, you know, I'm not a repair person. I'm not a DIY. Let's take off the panel and replace the chipset. No, just go buy a new one. And so I am absolutely not. I think certain things you can keep around for a long time. I just feel that, at least me, Chris in Miami, that technology is really just not one of those, unless you have something that is going to last a long time and work.
So privacy and security are probably the things to think about, less so longevity.
Yep.
And I think trust Google for security. Yeah. Trust them for privacy. Well, more than a Facebook doorbell, but maybe that's not the number one choice. Chris, hey, I appreciate the call.
Thanks.
It's great to talk to you.
Woo! Welcome back, boss.
More coffee.
Hey, three more cups, easy.
Calm down, man.
All right, easy.
Okay,
Leo, I appreciate you.
Thanks, Chris. Have a great one. We're going to go to Richard now in, I don't know where. Let's see where Richard is. Richard, welcome to the show. Join us inside the Magic Stargate. He got on mute. I can only
hear
that.
There we go. Richard is talking. I saw the microphone go whoop, whoop, whoop. Currently talking, but we're not hearing Richard.
I'm unmuted.
There we go.
No, it's not you. It's us.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, Richard.
How are you? So let's get off on the right start. I was your first caller to say that the Apple Watch saved my life.
Ah.
So you've heard it three times. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to share my story with you, as we did in the segment in 2021. And I want to get your opinions on what additional health applications we hopefully can look forward to from Apple Watch. And I've heard rumors about headphones and how can Apple continue to make our lives better?
Great question, Richard. Where are you calling from again?
Westchester, New York.
Westchester. And for people who didn't hear the radio show, so this is a couple of years ago, Richard called. Tell us in briefly, how did the Apple Watch save your life?
I was on vacation, a long-awaited vacation, towards the end of the COVID pandemic lockdown, and I was in Kona, Hawaii. And I had not been feeling well that day, laid down to take a nap, and my watch alerted me, woke me up, that I had an AFib incident going on. Backstory is I have it, my family and my father had a series of strokes. Kona, I knew, only had two ambulances. I couldn't wait at the MinuteClinic line. By the way, it was also monsoon rain outside.
Oh, Lord.
Wow.
I did what I suggested, what I would suggest nobody else do, which was drive myself to the hospital. Wow. About 30 miles.
Oh, wow.
When I got to the hospital, the cardiac intensive care doctor said that likely the watch saved my life. 18 hours into the AFib incident, he had threatened me with paddles. That's how close I was coming.
Imagine if you hadn't gotten that alert and then had an incident and you still have that monsoon rain, no ambulance. You're not driving yourself at that point. Yeah, it saved your life. Very clearly, that early warning made a huge difference. And I'm glad that we're still together and you're still here, Richard. It's wonderful.
Absolutely.
There's so much going on now with the Apple Watch. We've heard rumors, and this would be huge, and everybody wants to solve this, of non-invasive blood sugar measurement. As you know, anybody who's a diabetic, as I am, type 2 diabetic, you want to keep track of your blood sugar level. Ideally, you'd have kind of a continuous glucose monitoring, and they make those, but they're invasive. You have to stick something in your arm, and a little filament goes into your fluid in your skin and is measuring your blood sugar that way. Or you prick your finger and you measure your blood that way. If you're a type 1 diabetic and it's a life or death thing, you might be doing that several times a day. Or you might have a continuous glucose monitor attached to a pump that's pumping insulin into your body on demand. Wouldn't it be amazing for the more than 14 million diabetics in the country, if your Apple Watch, without invading, without pricking you or even putting a filament into your arm, could tell what your blood sugar was and continuously measure that. That is the holy grail. Tim Cook has kind of alluded to it over the years. They've bought companies to allow them, just recently bought another company that allows them to do that. But I think best guess for most people is several years off.
It's still a while away.
It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, it's a very hard thing to do. And the problem is there are the people who have thought about the ways to do it have taken a few different routes. And so trying to explore the ones that are the options that will work is a little difficult. We saw a Google attempt to do it by looking at the fluid in your eye, and that didn't really pan out. And what Apple appears to be doing as of late is looking at what's called interstitial fluid, which is fluid that it kind of exists between cells and in different parts of your body, in between rather structures, not cells. And by constantly monitoring that fluid, it can provide information about the glucose level in the body using what's kind of wild, sort of light refraction. So depending on how light is bouncing off of that fluid, if they can get the algorithms just right and get enough information, then it starts to give trends for glucose. But the problem is the technology to do it right now is still quite large. And so they've just gotten past the proof of concept stage with that, according to all of the, you know,
it's all rumors. Apple's not talking.
Yeah, Apple's not saying this. And so they want to take it from something, you know, that's the size of a phone to be able to minimize it so that it can go in the watch along with all the other tools that you already have in there. So it's still a ways away. But as Leo's has said, you know, this really is the holy grail. And I think that it's the holy grail, not just for folks right now who are, you know, diagnosed as diabetic, but for folks who might not know that they are, that does sometimes happen. And, you know, they've been having all these issues and then suddenly it comes out to be that their body was just not processing sugar as it was supposed to. And then also for anyone who, you know, the idea of having to prick your finger all the time or can't afford one of the regular glucose monitoring systems. I mean, there's just so much that could be done in this space that would be very helpful for many, many people. And I think that it could lead to just more awareness overall of our bodies and how they're responding to the different things that we put in and the different things that we do. The other field would be blood pressure. And it seems like that would be more likely addition sooner rather than later, because they can use, and it's kind of the same way that we look at pulse rate right now, a pulse oximeter, which kind of looks at how red the blood is in a fingertip or near your extremities. If they can look at sort of as your heart is beating and the way that the color changes from red to a different color, so how red it gets and then sort of drops in redness over and over and over again, mix that in with some magical algorithms, and you can start to determine someone's blood pressure from that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see blood pressure within the next two or three models of the Apple Watch, where blood glucose is something like five or six models out.
And as you point out, Doug, I think it's very likely that a lot of these will end up in your AirPods. I just went into for my annual checkup with my audiologist. And yeah, they're going to turn up my hearing aids a little bit, but I'm taking a look at, you know, what the hearing aid manufacturers are doing. Starkey now has fall detection in their hearing aids.
Oh, nice.
Which is a great thing to have fall detection on your watch. I got my mom, a 90-year-old mom, an Apple Watch specifically so that that fall detection would be there. And I know it works because once in a while. The other day, I set it off making the bed. Every once in a while, I'll whap my hand against something or something will happen and it'll go, bzz, 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 did you fall? So I know it's working, which is a good thing. And I think fall detection shouldn't be diminished. It seems like a low tech thing, but it's a very important, valuable thing.
My first alert yesterday was hiking and I did fall. I actually fell while I was hiking. I slipped on some very mossy rock next to the ocean.
Yeah.
And it said, did you fall? And I thought, I did, but I'm okay. So I guess I'm going to say no. So it knew that
Say, don't call emergency services, but I did fall.
That's good. I never had it happen before, so I didn't know what button to press.
It says stop. And then it asks you, well, did you actually fall or was this an error? And most of the time I say it was an error. I think down the road, though, I mean, if you go to CES, you'll see this year toilets that analyze your poop.
Yes.
I think down the road, we are going to... It's maybe a decade off, probably not in time for you and me, but sometime in the near future, good enough for Micah, we will see kind of full health metrics. You know, I mean, right now I go in and get my blood tested twice a year. Imagine if every day you had a blood analysis and you knew exactly what was going on. And then, of course, the next step is to tie it with therapeutics. And we're seeing improved therapeutics. Things like the mRNA vaccine shows us the way towards maybe even cancer treatments that are tailored to the genome of the cancer and your genome. I think we are on the edge of a real revolution in healthcare. A significant revolution, but we're not there yet. And it's not going to all happen with the Apple Watch, because I don't think it'll be analyzing your poop anytime soon. But but I do think that a lot of things are happening, and it's very exciting. It's a very exciting time. And I'm so thrilled that your life was saved by the Apple Watch is such an encouraging story. I love that.
Obviously, I've become an Apple fanboy.
Yeah.
After spending, with your guidance, by the way, about 33 years in the IT sector, mainly focused on Windows. Mm-hmm. At one point, I was servicing 7 different flavors of Windows between the servers and desktops.
You have my deepest respect, Richard.
Sincerely.
Let's just say that I retired about 4 months ago after 33 years.
Nice.
And all of my products right now are, I don't want to be a commercial for Tim Cook's products, but I'm a big fan.
I wear my watch every day now. You know, when I first got it, and I've told this story, and I was pretty vocal on the air, I thought it was a toy, a gimmick, an accessory that didn't have a huge amount of value. And perhaps in the early days it didn't.
Yeah.
But over time, they've really done a great job, and they've focused on health and fitness. And I think that was exactly the right direction to take this. I wouldn't be caught without my Apple Watch. You know?
That's how I feel now too. Yeah. In the same way, when I first had the Series Zero, as we called it, I would go without it for 3 or 4 days before I put it back on. Now, yeah, it's very, I feel naked without it.
Yeah.
It sounds silly, yeah, but it's true. It's on my watch, or it's on my wrist. I look at the time and I get all of the measurements, and I like having that information available to me.
Richard, a pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad to hear from you again, and I'm glad things are going well. And maybe next time go to Oahu, not Kona, and you'll be closer to medical services. I never even really thought about that. I'm dying to go to the wet side of Kona, but maybe I didn't know there were only 2 ambulances on the whole island. That's not good. Thank you, Richard. Have a wonderful day. All right. Take care, my friend. Isn't that a nice story? Of course, Apple has been advertising those like crazy. It's really been a big deal for Apple, and I think it sells a lot of watches. Certainly, I wouldn't have bought one for my mom except for that fall detection. And now you can set it up for kids and elders without them having an iPhone as well. You can set it up with your iPhone and give it to them. I think they're definitely on the right track.
And a rumor that iPads are around the corner as a means of setting
up. Yeah, isn't that interesting? So you could, what was the story? That you could pair your watch to multiple devices,
mm-hmm,
not multiple watches to a
not
single
multiple
device.
Watch. Well, but you can do that with the iPhone.
You can have
multiple
2 watches,
paired to this iPhone. So hopefully it would be the same on both.
So you wouldn't have to have an iPhone to get an Apple Watch. You
that
could have
is,
an iPad
yeah.
or a Mac.
That would be cool. I did not read about the Mac,
okay,
but that would be nice.
An iOS device.
Because then I could set up, you know, my whole family's.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Micah Sargent, if you like iOS and you want to know more about watches, iPads, and iPhones, he's got a great show. iOS Today, every Tuesday with Rosemary Orchard. You could subscribe. You can even watch it live. It's right before Mac Break Weekly. It's kind of an Apple morning.
It's a nice morning with Apple. Yeah.
You'll also catch him on Tech News Weekly, where they talk to newsmakers and really get some of the biggest newsmakers on. We're going to do Twit in just a few minutes, and I'm excited. We've got Brianna Wu stopping in. We'll talk about Blue Sky with Brianna. She's all in on Blue Sky. And one of the great security guys, Alex Stamos, famous for his work at Facebook. He was hired by Zoom to turn it around for them. He's worked everywhere and does a wonderful security podcast. He's going to join us on Twit this next half hour or so. We have to have the Sacramento Kings game on in the background because apparently he's giving up his NBA to be with us. I want to thank, as I have earlier, all our Club Twit members, and invite you, if you're not yet a member, to join Club Twit. $7 a month does not pay for Leo's vacations. I want to say that up front.
Yeah, that's not.
What it does is it keeps the lights on, keeps the show going, keeps Micah here, keeps Ann here, keeps Jason here, and most importantly, lets us launch new shows like This Week in Space, Micah's Hands on Macintosh, Paul Thurrott's Hands on Windows, the Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett. We've got Stacy's Book Club. We have events. All of these happen in the Discord. That's another reason why you might want to join Club Twit, because that Discord is so much fun to hang out in, be a part of, and, of course, ad-free versions of all of the shows. I think that's more and more important as time goes by, because people, if you want privacy, we don't want to leak your information. We never will to advertisers, but advertisers are demanding to know more and more and more about our audience. We're trying to balance that. You know, if you've got an ad-free show, you don't have to worry about that. There is a tracker-free and ad-free version of our shows. I'd frankly like to be doing that all the time for everything. And if Club Twit grows, maybe we can. You want to join? We'd appreciate it. We'd love to have you in there. There's individual plans. There's family plans. There's even corporate plans. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And I thank you in advance for the support. I think it's time to wrap up this fabulous episode.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to be doing a little Python over the week. Actually, I've been doing it all along. Taking that inky impression, and I'm going to write a program that will draw the time. I guess I'll start with the time of day as an image and then load it up into the inky impression once a minute. see how that works out. We're going to use Python and the pillow library, which is the Python image library. So maybe we'll have that next week. If not, the week after, we'll show you some of that. Take a step forward with our Raspberry Pi. Who's on the show next week too? Is it time for
two folks on the show?
Two folks. We've got a very rich.
You've got Scott Wilkinson and Johnny Jett.
This man knows all. It's probably because you're using that Miro thing that we put together.
Oh.
Johnny Jett and Scott Wilkinson next week. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then for folks who are fans of the early days of Ask the Tech, or rather for the Tech Guy radio show, it's going to be a unique episode next week because Leo will be hosting it solo.
You're not going to be here?
No, I won't be here this Sunday.
It'll be like the old show. I'll have to do it all the heavy lifting. Oh, man.
But you have two guests, so that's good.
That's good. Okay. Maybe I won't do the Python thing next week. I might just be rooted to the chair. Where are you going? Are you going somewhere fun?
Yeah, I'm going to my happy place.
Always a good place to go, your happy place. And you know what's nice? The airfare is fairly affordable.
Yeah, it's very affordable. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, have a good time in your happy place, Micah Sargent. We will see you in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. We will see you, however, next week. We do Ask the Tech Guys every Sunday afternoon. Actually, it's afternoon for some, morning for us, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time. That's 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern time. That's, let's see, 1800 UTC. The live stream is at live.twit.tv. We turn it on as soon as we get into studio. So it may be a little earlier than that, maybe a little bit later than that, but roughly around that time, live.twit.tv. If you're in there watching us or listening to us, then you should probably be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, chatting with all the other folks. Or you could join us in the Discord. That's my happy place if you're a Club Twit member. We will be back next Sunday. I hope you will. Too. I'm Leo Laporte.
And I'm Micah Sargent.
Thanks for joining us. Have a great geek week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.